That was the legal justification for the CIA's Angolan paramilitary program. Behind it lay a lot of history. After 5 centuries of colonial rule and 15 years of bloody guerrilla warfare, Portugal was freeing its last African possession. In January 1975, a transition government had been established with each of 3 major liberation movements sharing in the preparations for independence, and each campaigning throughout the country for elections in October 1975. Independence Day would be November 11, 1975. The 3 movements were the Popular Movement, or MPLA, Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, the National Front, or FNLA, National Front for the Liberation of Angola, and UNITA, National Union for the Total Independence of Angola. All 3 historically received help from communist countries, but the MPLA leaders had Marxist anti-imperialist views and had once been openly critical of the United States and its support of Portugal. The newspapers spoke of the Soviet-backed MPLA and the moderate FNLA. During the spring of 1975, the transitional government had disintegrated as FNLA and MPLA forces clashed in northern Angola. In July 1975, the MPLA prevailed, evicting the FNLA and UNITA from the capital, Luanda. I was familiar with the Portuguese colony on the South Atlantic side of Africa from childhood and adult travels. We had visited the Angolan ports, Luanda and Lobito, and had met American missionaries who told alarming tales about Portuguese administrators in the Angolan bush. In 1961, a U.S. Navy ship, on which I was the Marine Corps intelligence officer, put into Luanda for a brief visit. CIA assignments and temporary duty missions had placed me near Angola many times, for example, in Lubumbashi, Zaire, in 1967, when Bob Denard's squad of 16 mercenaries invaded from the Angolan border. My last direct experience with Angolan matters had been in February 1969, when I drove from Lubumbashi to visit an FNLA camp near the Angolan border. It had been sleepy and undisciplined, and perhaps the experience inclined me to underestimate the tenacity of the Angolan National Movement years later. A few leaderless soldiers in ragged uniforms and semi-naked women and children shambled between dilapidated brick buildings, which were the remains of a Belgian colonial force publique camp. Without utilities or sanitary facilities, it differed little from a primitive African village, the small brick houses replacing thatch huts, and rusty rifles substituting for more primitive weapons. I was viewed with guarded suspicion at first, then with guarded friendliness after I shared some cigarettes and identified myself. I later wrote an intelligence report about the camp, which headquarters report officers refused to disseminate to the intelligence users in Washington. The chief of station, Kinshasa, sent me a note in the classified pouch advising that the agency wasn't interested in Angolan revolutionary movements, and that my visit was unfortunate because it could have been misconstrued. We didn't support the black fighters, and we didn't want our NATO ally, Portugal, picking up reports that we were visiting Angolan rebel base camps. Since then, I had casually monitored our Angolan policy, which was unchanged as late as 1974. It is part of the business to keep an eye on your areas of special interest. You do it casually, instinctively, over coffee with friends, or when you pass in the halls. What's the hurry? Oh? What's Roberto up to these days? Why hasn't anyone ever gotten us a line into the other group, the MPLA? For many years, the Portuguese had claimed exemplary success in assimilating blacks into a colonial society which was allegedly free of racial barriers. Until 1974, they appeared to believe they enjoyed a permanent relationship with their colonies. In the clandestine services of the CIA, we were inclined to accept the Portuguese claims of a racially open-minded society in Angola, and it was tacitly agreed that communist agitation was largely responsible for the blacks' continued resistance to Portuguese rule. The reason was basic. Essentially a conservative organization, the CIA maintains secret liaison with local security services wherever it operates. Its stations are universally part of the official communities of the host countries. CASE officers live comfortable lives among the economic elite. Even outside or deep cover CASE officers are part of that elite. They become conditioned to the mentality of the authoritarian figures, the police chiefs with whom they work and socialize, and eventually share their resentment of revolutionaries who threaten the status quo. They are ill at ease with democracies and popular movements, too fickle and hard to predict. Thus, CIA CASE officers sympathized with the whites of South Africa, brushing aside evidence of oppression with shallow clichés such as, "The only reason anyone gets upset about South Africa is because whites are controlling blacks. If blacks murder blacks in Uganda, nobody cares." And, "The blacks in South Africa are better off than blacks anywhere else in Africa. Better schools, better jobs, better hospitals." About Angola, we commonly declared, "The Portuguese have established a raceless society. They've intermarried and..." In fact, the Portuguese role in Angola was historically one of exploitation and brutal suppression. Beginning in 1498, it conquered and subjugated the three dominant tribal kingdoms, the Bakongo, Mbumdu, and Ovambundu, and exported over 3 million slaves, leaving vast reaches of the colony underpopulated. The colonial society was segregated into 6 racial categories, defined by the portion of white blood in each, with 2 categories of pure blacks at the bottom of the scale. Citizenship, economic, and legal privilege accrued only to the 600,000 whites, mulattoes, and assimilados, or blacks who were legally accepted among the elite of the society. The 90% of the population, classified as indigenous, suffered every form of discrimination, including forced labor, beatings, arbitrary imprisonment, and execution without trial at the hands of the colonial administrators. In 1958, there were 203 doctors in all of Angola, statistically one for every 22,400 Angolans, although most of those 200 served only European, mulatto, or assimilado patients, while a handful tended the 6 million Angolan indigenous. Less than 1% of the indigenous had as much as 3 years of schooling. John Markham, an American scholar who visited the interior of Angola in the early 1960s, walking 800 miles into the FNLA guerrilla camps in northern Angola, reports that at the time rebellion erupted in 1961, 2 million Angolan natives were displaced from their historic social and geographic surroundings. 800,000 were subject to rural forced labor. 350,000 faced underemployment in the slums of the urban areas, and about 1 million were émigrés in the Congo, Rhodesia, and South Africa. The disintegration of traditional society had led to widespread disorientation, despair, and preparations for violent protest. By 1961, Angola was a black powder keg, with the 3 major ethnic groups organized for revolt. On March 15, 1961, FNLA guerrillas mounted a 50-pronged attack across the Congo border along a 400-mile front, killing African and Portuguese men, women, and children alike. Portuguese Air Force planes immediately brought in military reinforcements, using NATO arms intended for the defense of the North Atlantic area, and began striking back with indiscriminate wrath, even bombing and strafing areas that had not been affected by the nationalist uprising. Portuguese police seized nationalists, Protestants, communists, and systematically eliminated black leaders by execution and terrorism. By overreacting and flaying out indiscriminately, the Portuguese helped to ensure the insurrection would not be localized or quashed. President Kennedy made a tentative gesture of support to the revolutionaries by voting with the majority of 73-2, South Africa and Spain opposing, on United Nations General Assembly Resolution 1514, April 20, 1961, which called for reforms in Angola. The United States also cut a planned military assistance program from $25 million to $3 million and imposed a ban on the commercial sale of arms to Portugal. But the Portuguese held a very high card. The Azores air bases that refueled up to 40 U.S. Air Force transports a day. We could not do without them, and our agreement for their use was due to expire December 31, 1962, only 18 months away. By renegotiating the agreement on a year-by-year basis, the Portuguese were able to stymie further pressure from Washington and obtain extensive military loans and financial credits. Even as American bombs and napalm fell on the Angolan nationalists and the U.S. voted the conservative line at the UN, Portugal's Air Force Chief of Staff, General Tiago Mina Delgado, was honored in Washington, receiving the American Legion of Merit from the U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff, Curtis LeMay, and a citation from Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara for his contribution to U.S.-Portuguese friendship. Strategic realities dominated policy. Lisbon attributed the war in northern Angola to Congolese invaders and outside agitators acting with a rabble of hemp-smoking indigenous, and for years thereafter, while the rebellion sputtered and flared, the United States ignored Angolan revolutionary movements. With the advent of the Nixon administration in 1969, a major review of American policy towards southern Africa, the Tarbaby Report, NSSM 39, concluded that African insurgent movements were ineffectual, not, quote, realistic or supportable, unquote, alternatives to continued colonial rule. The Interdepartmental Policy Review, commissioned by then White House advisor Henry Kissinger, questioned, quote, the depth and permanence of black resolve, unquote, and, quote, ruled out a black victory at any stage, unquote. Events soon proved this to be a basic miscalculation. The April 1974 coup in Portugal caught the United States by surprise. Without graceful policy alternatives, and out of contact with the African revolutionaries. Footnote. The Pike Committee Report, January 1976, analyzes the Portuguese coup as illustrative of a CIA intelligence failure. End footnote. The CIA had not had coverage inside Angola from the late 1950s until 1975. An official CIA station is opened only with the approval of the State Department, generally under the cover of a United States embassy or consulate. Only in rare instances is the presence of a CIA station truly unknown to the host government. Hence, in deference to Portuguese sensibilities, the subject of reopening the Luanda station was inevitably vetoed whenever it arose. Only in March 1975, when the Portuguese were disengaging and losing control, did we finally reopen the Luanda station. Before that, most of the CIA's field intelligence about the interior of Angola had come from Holden Roberto, who was the leader since 1960 of the Bakongo Revolutionary Movement, called the FNLA. Operating from Kinshasa, then called Leopoldville, he had established ties with the CIA. I was less familiar with the other two factions, the MPLA and UNITA, but I knew that the latter, headed by a tough radical named Jonas Savimbi, had been supported by the North Koreans and the Chinese. I had a personal memory of Savimbi. In 1968, he had delayed the arrival of my own household effects in Lubumbashi by harassing the Benguela Railroad, which was Southern Zaire's vital link to the sea, bringing in all supplies and carrying the Katanga province's copper to market. All three, Roberto and Savimbi, and the MPLA, would dominate my interest until the Angolan drama was finally played out. I picked up the memorandum to the Director of Central Intelligence. It had been drafted in Africa Division and was designed to introduce the 40 Committee Angola Options paper to the Director. I read it carefully. In the second paragraph, it stated that large supplies of arms to Roberto and Savimbi would not guarantee they could establish control of all Angola, but that assistance would permit them to achieve a military balance which would avoid a cheap Neto victory. Agostinho Neto was president of the MPLA. I paused to reflect a moment. This memo did indeed state a no-win policy. We would be seeking from the outset only to avoid a, quote, cheap Neto victory, unquote. I wondered what cheap meant. Would it be measured in dollars or in African lives? The Soviets would certainly learn what the agency was doing, and they knew very well the limitations which would be imposed on Kissinger and Ford by the American Congress and press so soon after Vietnam. $14 million doesn't stake you to a very big war. The Congo covert action cost American taxpayers $1 million a day for a sustained period. The CIA claimed to have won that one, although it was by no means clear 10 years later what we had won. Mobutu was energetically running the country into the ground, and he had turned on his American benefactors. The fourth paragraph of the memorandum to the director stated that the CIA understood, A, that Secretary Kissinger favored a $14 million commitment with emphasis on material, B, that the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Nathaniel Davis, opposed any covert program in Angola because he doubted that such an operation could be kept secret, and C, that Ambassador Sheldon Vance, career ambassador and special assistant to the Secretary of State, was interested in the operation because it would ease our relations with Mobutu. Footnote. Nathaniel Davis resigned in August 1975 after Secretary Kissinger rejected his recommendation that the United States seek a diplomatic solution in Angola and play no active role in the country's civil war. Davis had argued that we must mount a diplomatic effort, a multinational effort, to get a settlement. He said we must trumpet it to the world that this is not the right kind of activity for any great power. And he told them it wouldn't work. Quote, "Neither Savimbi nor Roberto are good fighters. It's the wrong game, and the players we've got are losers." Unquote. Seymour Hersh, from officials directly involved, New York Times, December 14, 1975. End footnote. Kissinger favors. I wondered if Kissinger or any of the others who were pushing us into this program were already planning its escalation. Bantam had said they got $6 million and then immediately $8 million more. Did they expect that to suffice? Or were they already thinking of another 10, 20, 100 million once they had the American government committed? Assistant Secretary Davis opposed the program. Bantam and I and Costello had reservations about it. How many others? Was there any chance for secrecy in a highly controversial program? I turned to the 40 committee options paper. It had been drafted by Africa Division of the CIA on July 14th, 2 weeks earlier, and began with a summary paragraph which concluded that Neto's forces appeared strong enough to take the Angolan capital, Luanda, and surrounding areas. Mobutu was exhausted economically and could no longer support Holden Roberto. Roberto did not have countrywide political support. It further postulated that financial and some limited material support to Roberto and Savimbi could establish a military balance and discourage further resort to arms in Angola. Such covert financial assistance, it continued, would prevent the quick and cheap installation in Angola of what Mobutu and Kaunda would regard as a pawn of Moscow on their borders. By putting in a little money and arms, we would discourage further resort to arms? President Johnson had called that controlled escalation in Vietnam. Why did the 40 Committee think it would work in Angola? The paper went on to review the recent developments in Angola and noted that Roberto had been given $265,000, with 40 Committee approval, since January 22, 1975, to make him competitive in the transitional government. It then listed four options for the United States in Angola. A. Limited financial support for political activity. B. Substantial financial support and covert action designed to redress the balance, costing $6 million. C. Larger amounts of money, $14 million, and material to give Savimbi and Roberto superiority over Neto, providing the USSR did not escalate its assistance to the MPLA. D. Sufficient support to sustain Roberto and Savimbi's armies for a year, costing $40 million. The latter, the paper stated, would likely match any Soviet escalation. There was no indication of how this estimate of Soviet response had been developed. A fifth option, of staying out of the conflict altogether, was not mentioned. Clearly, the United States wanted this war. Conspicuously, we had made no move to work through the Organization of African Unity, the United Nations, or bilaterally with the Soviet Union to end the arms race. The paper discussed the risks, concluding that the security of our program would be better protected if the Angolans got arms which had belonged to the Zairean army rather than from the USA. Officially, the United States was observing an arms embargo and should continue to do so. Broad allegations of massive American assistance to Mobutu and Roberto would not hurt us too badly. but a leak from an official American source would be damaging. The United States would be held to blame for spreading the civil war in Angola. The major fear was that some American official would leak the program to the American press, the American public. From the outset, the program was being kept secret from the American people more than anyone else. I finished with the 40 Committee paper and read several other pages of notes and draft memos. I learned that Colby had briefed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the Special Subcommittee on Intelligence of the House Armed Services Committee, and the Defense Subcommittee of the House Appropriations Committee to flesh out the presidential finding as required by the Hughes-Ryan Amendment. The 40 Committee had met once in January 1975, once in June, and again in July to discuss the Angola program. The National Security Council had met June 27, 1975, and requested that it be presented an options paper on Angola. This was the paper I had just read. On July 14, 1975, the 40 Committee had requested that the agency submit a covert action plan for the Angolan operation. This plan was drafted by Africa Division of the CIA and submitted July 16th. It was approved the same day by President Ford, who authorized the expenditure of $6 million. On July 27th, Ford had authorized the additional $8 million. On July 29th, the first plane load of arms left South Carolina for Kinshasa. It was after 9 p.m. when Bantam interrupted my reading to invite me to his new condominium in McLean, where we had dinner in a virtual museum of Oriental art, still only half sorted out. A packing crate in one corner had "Am Embassy Jakarta" printed on one side. At 1 a.m., I finally stretched out in the tub of his guest bath and reflected. While on leave, I had almost convinced myself that I should get out of the clandestine services, that I did not want to travel the world living fictitious cover stories and cultivating spies all my life. Now this incredible offer had come along. From my earliest days with the agency, I had promised myself three things: that I would always separate in my own mind the truth from the professional cover stories and lies, that I would never be afraid of the agency or any of its directors, and that I would not stay with it too long. Vietnam had almost been too long. After that, I knew that if I did not act to resolve my conflicts with the agency, I risked becoming one of the burned-out middle-grade case officers that clog the halls of CIA headquarters. On April 23rd, I had flown out of Saigon in a C-130 to a refugee tent city at Clark Air Force Base, exhausted and demoralized. Bitter memories crowded in while I lay for days on a cot staring at the green tent canvas overhead, waiting for a flight to the States. A week later, I was back at headquarters, wandering down the halls, sticking my head in offices, enjoying the warm greetings from old buddies and the curious stares of new officers. In from the cold? Case officers often come back unnoticed, drained by their experiences, and haunted by their consciences, by the suspicion that the things they had done were pointless as well as cruel. They rarely have the same sparkle and drive on the next assignment, or the next. In offices throughout the headquarters, there were those who had given up, who were walking out their years before early retirement, becoming gray fixtures like the safes and Xerox machines. I had reached an enviable level. Senior officers were cordial and accepted me almost as an insider, and the younger officers sought out my company. I was making $32,000 a year. In 12 years, I could expect to retire with a $20,000 pension. Security. The CIA almost never terminated staff officers before retirement age. Perhaps I could find a change of pace within the CIA itself, something out of operations that would keep the momentum of my career going. Now, in one day, I had come from the sleepy hills of Central Texas to learn of the CIA's latest super-secret covert action, a war that could easily escalate into a major confrontation with the Soviet Union. They were asking me to play a major role in planning and running it. I decided to stay a few days longer, to understand this new paramilitary thing, IA feature, and then face a tough decision.